Welcome to Single Serving Cinema with Tim and Tay, a podcast that looks at one critical scene in a movie every other week. We explore how the scene is constructed, what the scene achieves, and what it can tell us about the movie as a whole. I'm Tim.
I'm Tay. How's it going, movie fans? All you Harrys and Sallys out there?
Yeah, how's everyone doing? We are talking about When Harry Met Sally today. We're doing our New York movie audience pick, our listener vote pick, however I always fail to term it properly. But to kick it off, Tay, I wanted to ask you, do you know what hospital corners are? Because I had to Google it.
I didn't Google it, but I also didn't know what it meant when it came up in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In the scene we're talking about today, Harry calls Sally Little Miss Hospital Corners.
I think I'm entitled to throw a little anger your way, especially when I'm being told how to live my life by Miss Hospital Corners.
And stick around and you'll find out what that means via my Google internet research.
Wow. Very, very good lead.
I mean, this is the strategy now. We got to get people to stick around to the end, right? Not just the beginning where all the fun stuff happens, like the paperwork and the taglines.
Yeah. Everyone just sticks around to the tagline, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some more news, something else for the future. This month, March, we're doing New York movies. We talked about Spider-Man 2 weeks ago. We're doing When Harry Met Sally today. Next month, we're going to try and line up with, Mario, with the Mario movie.
Did you already forget Mario is coming out next month?
Yeah, does everyone know? Is everyone aware Mario is coming out next month and it's probably going to be a movie?
Coming. I'm not afraid. I'll do anything for my brother.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about animated movies. That's what we're lining up. We're going real general. Tay and I do not have the guts to do a video game movie month. Because we can't take the risk that you guys are going to make us talk about Assassin's Creed or something like that. And, you know, we're only on this earth for so long. And I watched Assassin's Creed on an airplane once and that's all I got in me.
I don't think I'd waste any more time on it. I think it'd be really, really, really tough.
What do you want from me?
Your past.
Yeah, so we're talking animated movies, which we haven't done in a while. So keep an eye out for that listener vote near the end of March. And when we announce what movie that we're going to pick for ourselves. We had decided on one, Tay, like behind the scenes. But then I realized there was another one I might want to do instead. We got to chat about that. It's all teasers at the opening of this episode, eh? Just a lot of this will happen later.
Yeah, and another tease for everybody. Someone won an Oscar last night.
Yeah, someone won an Oscar. Who won?
Some people won some Oscars.
It's an interesting way to put it. People won Oscars last night because the Oscars were last night. Tay, did you watch the Oscars?
Hell to the no.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't have like a huge like barrier against the Oscars or anything like that. I honestly just didn't really care. And when I remembered last night that it was on, I just rather watch Harry and Sally for the second time this week instead. So I did that instead.
Yeah, I didn't watch it either. I normally I think I can get into watching the ceremony in the right social setting. Like if you have a good group of people, if you're having a couple drinks. Or making some food for it or doing a pool, but in and of itself, I don't find it interesting. And by all accounts, I heard that last night's ceremony was not particularly interesting because they really sort of tightened all the screws on it as a response to last year and the slap,
Jimmy Kimmel had one crack about the slap and that was about it.
I would think so. I heard. Yeah, he somehow made a joke about Will Smith, but did not use Will Smith's name, probably out of a legal wisdom. But I don't know. I mean, even last year, I was watching the, David, the guy who did The Green Knight, which we talked about on this podcast.
Is that David Lowery?
David Lowery's movie with Robert Redford. Is it The Old Man and the Gun?
I think it's just The Man and the Gun.
The Man and the Gun. I was watching that last year during the Oscar ceremony when my phone blew up and everyone was like, did you just see what happened? And now I want to do that for the Oscars from now on as I watch something else. and then people let me know about it. But in this case, I went to see a local concert. I saw what is, I understand to be the preeminent The Band cover band. And they came to town and they played Big Pink from start to back. It's a phenomenal show and great use of my time. So I'm really happy with how I decided to not watch the Oscars.
Is that album called Welcome to Big Pink? Or is it Big Pink?
Music from the Big Pink, I think.
Music from the Big Pink. Yeah. That's right.
I don't know. This is now The Band podcast. Sorry, everybody. Yeah. no, at some point, we might get to talk about The Last Waltz.
But, Canadian band, just saying.
Sort of. Right? It's
kind
of
Canadian, I think.
Almost all the guys are Canadian, but they're like American operating.
Right.
I mean, I feel the pride in them, but like, you know, they sing way more about like American Civil War stuff and Americana. So it's a real wishy-washy argument.
I guess so. But they come from Canada. I'm proud that they're talented musicians. And it's cool you got to see a top-end cover band.
It was just a killer show. I've never seen so many people lose their minds over Up on Cripple Creek as a encore. Like, there was what verged on a mosh pit in front of the stage because the people were just so excited to hear Cripple Creek.
That's like a less moshy song than most of their songs, I feel.
These guys were rocking out. It was very unabashed and very enthusiastic, and it was a good crowd to be a part of. Now, we know, listeners, you come to this podcast for our discussions on The Band and The Band cover bands. This one was called Chest Fever, by the way. I never said their name. Check them out on Instagram. They're cool. We should probably talk a little bit about the Oscars. Everything Everywhere All at Once, which we featured in our 2022 recap, and the directors of which we talked about when we did Swiss Army Man for our A24 month back in September. It got 5 Oscars above the line, which no movie has ever done in 95 years of the Oscars. So that's 3 acting categories, director and picture, but they also got screenplay and editing.
Yeah, incredible.
Kind of insane. Like, there are other movies that have gotten more Oscars, like Return of the King, Cuckoo's Nest. There are a couple others, like Titanic, stuff like that.
Doesn't compete with the top. With the 5 over the line
again, I think it's the spread of the acting categories that really got it. And the other thing being that, like,
well, it got 3 of the 4 acting categories,
and it didn't even qualify. It's not like it lost lead actor. There was no lead actor performance.
That's right.
In it. So, like,
the
it got
lead actor did get his award for supporting, right?
Yes. Yeah. Precisely. So, I mean,
fantastic.
It's kind of insane because, like, leading up to this, if you're tuned into the conversation at all, at a certain point, it was kind of like the easiest bet to make was that everything would get Best Picture. Whether Daniels would get director at the same time was maybe an unknown quantity. And
I'd say the director's field was the toughest to guess this year. It's always hard when you have like the big hitters coming up with something personal, like Steven Spielberg making The Fablemans this year.
Yeah, I think there was a chance it could have been Spielberg. I think there was a chance it could have been Todd Field, who I probably would have given it to Todd Field because I think the creativity and like unboundedness of everything is great, but I also think like it maybe could have done with a bit more editing and a bit more control. I don't know how you do that without compromising the movie because the movie is so out of control. And I think it's always also a weird thing to anytime suggest that you could give something Best Picture, but not the people who made it Best Director. That's a weird argument.
I can see the difference, but I understand how some people can't separate the two.
Yeah, and I mean, Best Picture can mean a bunch of different things, right? Like, there's an argument to be made that Top Gun was the Best Picture because it was like a revival of cinema post-pandemic, right?
Yeah, I honestly think that that's a big reason why it was even in the category, and I was happy it did get the award for sound.
Yes, and I think like a great pick for it, right? The ones that I really Oh, go ahead.
I will just say, I think it's an embarrassment that they put the two sound categories into one category. I think that's stupid way to like really relegate the technical categories and focus on like the less important things like original song.
Mm-hmm.
Like
the original song is always kind of silly, even though, you know, that kind of like promotion of that category created more business for making those songs, and every now and then gives us an amazing song like Seal's "Kiss from a Rose" from the first Batman movie.
Batman Forever? Wait, no, isn't it? It's Batman Forever, I think.
Oh, you're right. It's not even the first one, is it?
But yeah.
What that song has to do with that movie, I don't know, but it's a killer track.
And, well, it's my friend Lucas's favorite movie and favorite song, so that's why they're together, actually.
Right. Well, we'll have Lucas on when we do our Batman month, and people pick Batman Forever somehow.
Well, I will say that Lucas was pretty frustrated he didn't get invited to be on the Spider-Man podcast.
Oh, I see. Well.
Yeah. He claims to be quite the expert, but he does hold hope for Spider-Man 2.
He had a lot of thoughts on that Thanksgiving dinner scene that we were doing, all these things we didn't touch on.
Yeah.
No, I mean, but it just really, we can conclude the Oscars thing. The things that I guess I would take umbrage with from it were Jamie Lee Curtis getting Best Supporting Actress for that performance in Everything is kind of weird.
I didn't pick her for the category. It was the only category in the top five I didn't get right, actually.
There's nothing wrong with her performance, but it's not like... It's not like this tower, right? It's not this thing that you can point to from the year. And it like, and admittedly, the Oscars often will give people like a legacy Oscar where it's, more awarding your career, right?
Has she won before?
Oh, no. I mean, well, she largely is only ever in like genre fair, right? Like she's a scream queen. She's in comedies. She doesn't do a lot of things that are like Oscar baity, which, you know, you can... That's a good thing and a bad thing. Like Tar, I love to death. I think it's a phenomenal movie. I would have given it director. And I think Blanchette deserved actress as much as Michelle Yeoh, but I'm happy that Michelle Yeoh got it because she probably wouldn't
get another
chance.
I would have been happy with either. I haven't even seen Tar yet, but I understand the magnitudinal performance.
Yeah, Tar, as great as it is, like that is your conventional Oscar fare and Oscar bait. So, I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is never in stuff like that, so I appreciate them addressing her career, but I mean, especially from that movie, because they had two nominees in it, I would have given it to Stephanie Hsu.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the only other complaint, this is getting really, really deep in the weeds, but they gave Best Original Score to All Quiet on the Western Front, which has one very cool idea in it, and it is an undeniably cool idea for this score, which is like this big electronic pulse comes in, and it's otherwise a period drama. I don't have you watched it yet, Tay?
No.
Yeah.
I don't think I will.
It's good. I'm never going to watch it again.
I've seen the original.
Yeah. But the score has like one very cool idea, and then that's just kind of it. And like the fact that it won for that idea is wild. And then the other thing, and like Tay, only if you have the time and you really feel like it. But if you align the main theme from All Quiet on the Western Front with now, listeners, like I hope some of you know what I'm talking about when I say this, Sean Kingston's Fire Burning on the Dance Floor. She's fire burning, fire burning. I think they have the exact same first three notes.
What's up, Quad? Killer track.
Like I don't know about that, but like it sticks in you. It's catchy. And
it's fire.
It aligns in my mind exactly with the All Quiet on the Western Front, like three note motif that it clearly won the Oscar for, which I think makes it very silly to me. And I really, you know, Justin Hurwitz has done a lot of good work in composition over the course of his career working with Damien Chazelle, and the score for Babylon was fantastic. And I think much more deserving, but those are my quibbles.
Even without seeing a good chunk of the movies this year, I'd still made my picks, and it really just proves like the fact that I was able to guess most of these picks just based on reputation of movie just kind of goes to show the flaw in the Oscar selection process. Like actually pick Hurwitz for Babylon, even though I haven't seen that movie, just because I know how he is regarded. But that's one of the only ones I got wrong.
Right on. I mean, I don't know if that's an indictment of the Oscars themselves when things aren't a surprise. Sometimes like I think the cultural conversation over the course of the Oscar season is sometimes a little bit more sewn up than it is otherwise. You know, yeah, in recent years, you know, you had like the surprise Coda, surprise Moonlight. A lot of like modern younger movies are taking over, and like everything really feels like the clincher here, that they're saying like this is an entirely new sort of era for what we're awarding.
I guess some things just feel like they are awards just feel like they're only given because of the extra parameters surrounding the particular instance. Like, so Brendan Fraser, phenomenal performance in The Whale this year, but you could have called it from the second that the movie was made, he was going to win.
Yeah, it was his comeback Oscar, not even necessarily his Whale Oscar.
And I've heard so many good things about other performances in that category, like particularly Colin Farrell's in Banshees, and people have also come out and said like this was Colin Farrell's like year to win, like this was his best performance.
And the further I get away from The Whale, the more I was kind of like, oh yeah, Colin Farrell actually, like the Whale performance, great, but like kind of like dimmed in my mind over time. The further, you know, just the more time it sat with me and fell back into the back of my mind. But no, Colin Farrell, it really grew with me. And I mean, you know, a great year for him in general. You put Banshees of Inisherin on one side and The Penguin on the other. This guy's got range.
Yeah, man. And he, I don't know if you heard some of those interviews. I've been watching a lot of Colin Farrell interviews over the past couple months. He talked about how much fun it was to just play The Penguin. He's like, just, it feels like you're not even you. So you can just do whatever you want because you have all this prosthetics on. You feel like a different person and you feel unhinged. And he said he had so much fun playing that role. And like, he's just very optimistic and positive about that experience, which I thought was kind of refreshing. And then I've just heard nothing but amazing things about Banshees, so it's still very high on my list. I will watch it very soon, promise.
Yeah.
I'll try and give my feedback on the pod when I do come around to watching that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, we'll...
If you have nothing else about the Oscars, I'd say a fun way to kind of tie it back into our movie discussion for today is by saying that we truly could use Billy Crystal back as the host of the Oscars.
Yeah.
he continues to be like the beacon of light in terms of Oscar host history. Mm-hmm. Everyone will like reminisce about all the crazy stuff he pulled as a host, and the fact that his hosting experience has been so memorable across time just make me think like, get this guy back in a permanent job. Like, what is he doing anymore? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care how old he is, he's still probably way better than getting Jimmy Kimmel on the stage.
Yeah, I mean, I got no issue with Jimmy Kimmel. I also, sure. No, you know, I didn't watch the ceremony, so like, how much could I actually like any of this? But I remember as a kid, I would watch a Billy one, yeah. And like, I remember as a kid, like, they're obvious jokes, but like, they worked on me when I was like 8, and he was like, you know, they'd put him into the scene, and he'd be like Gollum or Gandalf or something.
I haven't been to the Oscars since they were taken over by the evil wizards.
You mean the orcs?
No, the Weinsteins.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obvious. It's right there. But like, if it makes you laugh, it makes you laugh. And I always enjoyed those.
Yeah, he has a funny way of being like, I don't know, comedic over to a broad audience. He can really command it and has a funny way of being quick on his feet.
It feels like he's a bit of a different generation or a different era of entertainer that isn't really around anymore. And you see that in the movie we're talking about today, When Harry Met Sally. Yeah. He sings in this movie. He does some physical comedy in this movie. He goes big. He goes small. Like he's got a real command. He's got a real command over both having like a dead-eyed, unfocused stare and yelling a line or singing Oklahoma in the middle of a sharper image. Which, I mean, what a sentence that was, right? Like, we're going back to 1989 with this one, everyone. Again, we appreciate you guys voting for it. This is our first rom-com that we're doing, and it's a great one to talk about because it's kind of in conversation with rom-coms and with, I think, the romantic culture at the time.
It's definitely a zeitgeist encapsulation of like the late 80s, early 90s period. Mm-hmm. My parents are kind of this age group. I'm assuming yours are kind of similar too. So I recognize all the fashion trends. Mm-hmm. I recognize all the technological innovations. Mm-hmm. You know, just all these like really small bits of nostalgia that pop up throughout the whole movie. Mm-hmm. It was only my second time watching this movie when I watched it the first time for this podcast. I've now watched it 3 times total, but I've always been really impressed with how much I come to like this movie, you know? Not my genre, typically, but mostly that's a fact of I don't think there are very many strong films in the genre, not really a problem with the constraints of the genre itself, per se.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely fair, and I think we, over the course of the last decade, we saw, like, the general death of rom-coms, right? And, I mean, if you give me a second, let me find who directed...
Like, Knocked Up?
Well, if you even want, like, is that even a traditional rom-com, or is that an Apatow movie? Like, it's kind of half and half, right?
Half and
they
half,
move
right?
further into Apatow with stuff like Zach and Miri Make a Porno.
That's actually
intentionally non-traditional rom-com, right?
That one's with actually Kevin Smith, but...
Oh, that was Kevin Smith? Oh, no way. Good for him. I actually think this got a very touching turn in it. I actually really like how that relationship develops.
That movie is surprisingly good. Yeah.
Okay, so this other movie podcast that I love, The Big Picture, recently I was listening to one of the episodes, and one of the hosts made an argument that Andy Tennant, the guy who directed Hitch, which I think has a lot in common with When Harry Met Sally, Andy Tennant is responsible for the end of rom-coms as we know them, because he made every single bad one you can think of, like those McConaughey ones, the even more anonymous
like
ones.
Failure to Launch?
Yeah, like stuff like that. And How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Ever After, Sweet Home Alabama, The Bounty Hunter. So for anyone who maybe you're like Tay to some extent, and you don't watch a ton of rom-coms, they don't really appeal to you, that's 100% okay. If you haven't seen this movie, you've definitely heard references from it. It is an iconic movie, but just to walk you through some of the paperwork so you know what we're talking about when we talk about it. When Harry Met Sally is about maybe more than friends, Harry and Sally, as they navigate the dating world through their 30s, learning whether there really are any true rules defining the relationships between men and women. Starring Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal, and directed by Rob Reiner, and written by Nora Ephron, we should mention. When Harry Met Sally hit theaters July 21st, 1989. And make sure, if you haven't watched it and you want to, you can see where you can watch it by checking our show notes. We've got a link there.
So 1989 summer smash hit, making $92.8 million at the box office on a $16 million budget. Rom-coms don't make this much money nowadays, do they?
No, rom-coms get dropped anonymously onto Netflix and Amazon Prime, and like 4 people watch them. And if they're good, those people rewatch them like a year later.
Right.
Right. Like. Right. We back in February, we did a little poll on our Instagram with people to be like, what's your Valentine's Day movie? If you're going to put a movie on, what is it? And either like it's iconic romances like this. Tay, you picked one. Was it Bloody Valentine?
I'm actually going to pick that one for my shout out today, so I'll save it for last. My first pick for Valentine's Day is always My Bloody Valentine, Canadian classic.
Yeah. I picked Before Sunset. Slightly different tone, but that's just what I was feeling at the time. And then, but I mean, in general, it was a lot of people picking very classic rom-coms, like When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail, Moonstruck, another fantastic one. And then the few that were like more modern ones are these sort of like sleeper Netflix hits, like the one with Randall Park and Ali Wong from Netflix recently, Always Be My Maybe. There's one with our guy, Glenn, what's his face from
Glenn Powell.
Everybody Wants Some. Yeah. Glenn Powell and Zoe Deutsch, both from Everybody Wants Some. They're in a rom-com called The Setup that I actually quite enjoy. I think it's pretty funny, mainly because it's them.
Okay.
Yeah. And like this year they did put out, a Julia Roberts and George Clooney movie called,
oh, who cares anymore?
Ticket to Paradise. I was like, in my mind, it was Ticket to Ride. And I was like, there's no way they called it that.
Well, that would be more suiting for like the age group that movie applies to.
It's apparently no good at all, and it didn't make a ton of money. And like, that's why. Why are we talking about, I'm sorry, we shouldn't be talking about Ticket to Paradise. This is just such a tangent. When Harry Met Sally made $92 million on $16 million, insane return. Also, I would say like a pretty low budget. And I guess like, it's a lot of relatively simple sets, but like there are clearly scenes where they're closing down part of a street, like the one we're going to talk about today. It's a cleared street in New York, or a place that looks like New York.
I think one good clue
for your buck, even without the box office.
One clue that I had from watching the credits in their entirety was seeing that they thanked the Buffalo Bills stadium in Buffalo. So I'm guessing they all the sports stadium stuff in Buffalo, not actually in New York, which is still technically New York State. So I guess that's fair. you got to just think in terms of relative scheduling busyness of those kinds of venues. And yeah, obviously you take an hour trip up to Buffalo, mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to shoot that than getting the Giants stadium in New York City.
This is an extremely inexpensive movie, though. Impressively small. And I guess it's earlier in like Meg Ryan's career. She probably peaks within the next 5 years and probably has a way bigger quote price. But still, I would guess more than 16 mil.
You mean just in terms of the talent level?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Because yeah. She did Top Gun, Interspace, and then this.
I feel like You've Got Mail, or there's another key one, may even be
Sleepless in Seattle, When a Man Loves a Woman.
I think Seattle and You've Got Mail are maybe, like, this is clearly more iconic and remembered, but I'd say in terms of her garnering the asking price she wants, she probably made more money on Seattle or Mail.
I would say Sleepless in Seattle, she made a lot more money because that was her and Tom Hanks both kind of hitting their actual peaks.
And then they did again down in after You've that. Got Mail. Well, it's her and Hanks and You've Got Mail again. Taylor, like, I don't like your knowledge on this is you need an older sister who was watching these movies as you were growing up.
Yeah, where's this movie? Oh, I got it. 1998, You've Got Mail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, and I had a younger sister, so I watched things like, you know, The Princess Diaries over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Which I gotta say, not a bad movie at all.
Not a bad movie, right?
She's gonna barf. Look out, she's gonna hurl. Cover the tuba.
Pretty funny.
Who's her like limo driver butler in that? Isn't he like that rom com guy? He's always like the concierge in like Julia Roberts movies.
He's in a Pretty Woman. His name is like Hector Elizondo. Yeah. Yeah, he's excellent guy. In Princess Diaries, actually, now that you mention that.
Yeah. Okay, well, okay, let's get back on track here. The tagline for this movie is, can two friends sleep together and still love each other in the morning? And
My instant reaction is, I hate this tagline. I think it's a huge spoiler for what is, in my opinion, the more enticing aspect of the movie is watching this develop into that.
But I think this movie, as a response to modern dating culture, I think this is a very smart marketing ploy. Because
I agree. Because
they want to go into this murky water that, like, all the people they want in the theater have probably experienced in one way or another. Whether it's men being like, I have this friend, I find her very attractive, but we're just friends. And, you know, they would, much worse movies in the coming decades would delve more into, like, the friend zone and she's just not that into you and stuff like that, which isn't really a factor here. But this sort of shared experience, and then also, like, while we were getting the episode set up for recording today, I had IMDb open, and so it's silent playing the trailer at the top. And, like, in the trailer, they have, like, that post-sex scene, or sex sequence, I guess. They edit around it because it's a very clean movie otherwise. Shot where, like, Billy Crystal, Harry, is just sort of like clearly in shock a little bit and wanting to leave, and she's on him. So like they were very upfront that like, no, the thing is here, these are friends and they sleep together. Do they actually love each other? Can it work out? This whole movie is like this mirror being held up to the audience just to be like, we know how it works and we know that you know how it works, but maybe we're all wrong. Can we find a happier conclusion here? And I can dig more into that. I think this movie is a lot about rules or lack thereof. And ends up making a proclamation about the lack of rules in a very strategic and I think smart way in terms of Nora Ephron's script to make everyone feel good at the end.
Well, but that, before we that do does lend itself to the rewatchability of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we do, we should talk about it as a New York movie because that's what the theme is this month. What do you think, Tay?
Well, I think some things are pretty obvious, and then some things are more nuanced, I guess, about the New York influence on the characters and the script. I think inherently this is a New York movie because of the advertising and the way that it was the promotions for the film were, you know, images of Harry and Sally standing over the city of New York, or like with New York silhouetted in the background. So it was initially targeted as part of being part of New York. This story is a part of a New York story. So right away you kind of have that in it in mind. And then the opening scene of the movie is literally the two characters and their only time outside of New York is them getting to New York. So it starts with the journey to get there. And I think so it automatically places the viewer in the position of the unassuming main characters who are heading to the big city for the big city life experiences. And then the story becomes about how those experiences shape the rest of their lives, or their young lives, I guess I should say.
I think it's very implicitly a New York movie, because I think this movie really wants to and succeeds in feeling like a modern movie that has to be extremely in touch with like the adult romantic culture at the time. And like, so it would have to be in a city, obviously. And like, if you're talking about cities, you're talking about English speaking American cities, why wouldn't it be New York, right? Like, it is the setting of movies in cities. So like it feels foregone, and like maybe that what we're saying is all obvious, but like if you just consider like your alternatives at a moment, like it doesn't, like even like, you know, Sleepless in Seattle, you know, it's a different setting and things like that, but I think there's something very of the moment in having it here.
Yes.
And just populating this movie with different sequences of people, couples, whether it's Harry and Sally or Harry and Jess and Sally and Marie, doing inherently New York things, whether it's walking around or like speed walking through Central Park, or going to batting cages, or going to see, man, who's New York's football team that they go see?
The Giants. There is the Jets, but they go see the Giants.
Okay. Well, there you go. I don't know that much about football. I know a little bit more about rom-coms, but I couldn't have told you what team they were seeing. I even think like the iconography of like dragging a Christmas tree down the street that you bought like out front of like a big brownstone or a bodega. Again, I think we mentioned this on the Spider-Man podcast. Tay and I are not from New York. I have no experience in New York. Tay has some.
Yeah, I saw the Sex in the City house there.
Yeah, there you go. So you're a New Yorker, right? You're a Ratso Rizzo.
I will say that I was with a class trip, and we were given the choice to either stay around that area and tour more houses of celebrities or from TV shows, or we could walk around for 2 hours and do whatever we wanted. I took the latter option.
I think that's a good call. Like, that's what you want to do. You go and you stroll and you see what you see.
Well, I didn't feel like waiting around to see Sarah Jessica Parker if she might come around the corner, so.
Yeah. Star of Failure to Launch? You didn't want to see it? No, it's fine.
Way to bring it around.
I think a less precise thing, or a less surface thing about it, too, is like all the people in this movie, the people that travel in their circles, they're kind of like, again, we're not from this time and we're not from this location. But like, it really is what I assume about this, like sort of New York intellectuals, you know, kind of like effete, middle upper class white people. They all like, they have jobs, but you never see them doing them. Like Harry is a political consultant, legal counsel. They never talk about it because it doesn't matter. Like Jess's job comes more to the forefront because he's kind of like a very stuffy, like cultural critic is all you can tell. And like his, you know, he falls in love because someone can quote his own work, which is like one of the biggest slam dunks on men I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
And maybe doesn't make Carrie Fisher's character look good either. But again, everyone's just looking for someone. They just don't want to be alone. Whether it's healthy or not, we'll leave that to the psychiatrists in our listening audience. But yeah, like the people of it and and things like that. They really feel like that kind of maybe just one step above like the Seinfeld cast, right? And I think this film really feel like in terms of like income and social status and things like that, right?
Even the characters in Friends, right? That's always like the common complaint, like all these like young affluent people living in New York City somehow, even though we never see them have jobs.
Yeah, like, or like, and they're all working like gig jobs and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, where's the reality here?
Yeah. And I mean, I do think this film really presupposes the idea of Seinfeld. And I know that like that's a general cultural movement. You can probably point to a lot of different media at the time that sort of was very effectively distilled by Seinfeld and then turned into something way more nihilistic, because that's the key of Seinfeld, is that none of them are good people and none of them care about anything. But this whole movie is about you can exert control over what is inherently a chaotic experience, being a person, being alive and being self-aware, by pigeonholing people, by saying here are the rules, by categorizing people. And there's a fair amount of that in this movie, and then that is what Seinfeld is, right? Is they're a close talker, they double dip, you know, like it's just you have to be able to classify people, and it both makes you better than them and allows you to feel like you have some control over your life.
That's a good way of putting it. I you can definitely see the like the inklings of Seinfeld in this script. I do think that it was part of, like you said, a bigger social movement of the times in TV culture and movie culture, but I don't think that it's far off. Like, I really think that Harry's character really feels like a pre-version of Jerry in Seinfeld.
Yeah, well, and also, like, I'm sure to some extent, like, you know, Jerry Seinfeld brought to Seinfeld his stand-up, and apparently, so Billy Crystal, when he came onto this project, he punched up the Harry parts as a performer. So like, I'm sure like a good chunk of this is his own stand-up or it's observational humor, right? Which was huge at this time in the 90s. It was the key facet of stand-up and things like that.
Largely defined by Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think everyone can see the DNA at play here and things like that. But sort of to get back around to sort of the theme and the intention of this movie, Rob Reiner, the director, said that the only way this movie would work was if it really exposed what men and women really felt and really thought about. So it was supposed to almost be like this revealing sort of like probably like really in the zeitgeist, saying like we're going to peel all the layers back by having the sort of core relationship, be a man and a woman who will speak openly to one another, all the things that when you're trying to date a person, you're hiding these things or you're talking around them or they're the elephant in the room, right? And it verges on meta, I would say, but I realized in writing it, and I realized based on what you wrote in the notes to respond to it, it's very nuanced. And I think meta has changed, obviously, very drastically from then to now. Meta things right now are painfully in your face. Right?
Yeah, so
like have to be.
If you take what Harry and Sally did and put it in today's context, you end up with something like the 8-year engagement, or what's that movie where they have like the one night stand, but they have to stay for a second night because of a snowstorm. And it's like all about the rules of the one night stand. Or I watched that movie that you recommended to me a while ago. It's like Zac Efron and Miles Teller. That Awkward Moment, I think it's called.
Yeah.
That movie is about the rules of like these guys make a pact that they weren't going to get serious with these women that they were actually kind of falling for, just as like a pact. And it's like very in your face, like, no, we're men of this century. We need to put down these rules. We need to live our lives this way.
Yeah.
And it's like, whereas Harry and Sally, it's just like conversations between people that reveal these kind of secrets about relationships, or like hard-earned knowledge about relationships, versus like these things that like where literally like the trailer is telling you this is the problem between these men and women.
Yeah, it's like these later ones really are kind of, there's an awareness that they are a movie.
Yes.
Whereas this is still clearly like, well, we want this to be watchable and we don't want to be speaking to the audience, But it's a really fine balancing act where, like, you know, the original version of the script is called When Boy Meets Girl, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it has all these aspects, but it's not like they're talking about meet cutes. They're not talking about the components of a romantic comedy. They are talking about the components and the psychology of dating at that time. So when
exactly.
I say modern dating, I'm talking about 1989 dating. Again, I assume it's a little bit before my time, but based on this, you get the idea that they were very successful because in 2022, just last year, the film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. So, like, it did its job. I think it's a great document. Or I believe it's a great document. It has sold it to me.
Based on even just hearing, like I said earlier, people of my parents' age speak about this movie and, like, talk about going to see it in the theater. I've heard, like, stories about that. And just, it really does feel like people knew in the moment that this was, like, a cultural phenomena. Like, this is like, oh, you have to go see Harry and Sally. It's about our time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing.
Like, people younger than us, people who have never seen this movie, will almost certainly recognize the line, I'll have what she's having. Which is both, like, it's iconic, it's memorable, it's a funny sequence, and it's largely progressive too in talking in 1989 about female pleasure or lack thereof in a sexual relationship. And in the research that I was looking in, like, I guess earlier versions of this script had just a lot more of Harry controlling the scenes, right? And he does that a lot in general, right? He's the one always sort of explaining what the rules are. He's categorizing Sally as high maintenance, which is, I think the more you dig into that, the more problematic it is as a form of control and sort of like taking some agency out, because, like, kind of like the Napoleon complex, like, you can't argue about being high maintenance because it makes you high maintenance. You can't argue about,
right,
that sort of, like, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And, like, the way he labels her throughout the movie, I guess, in general.
Yeah, well, and I mean, like, I was trying to make an ongoing list of, like, all the sort of declarations that he makes, where it's men and women can't be friends, there's only that certain frame of time where you drive someone to the airport, Sheldons are not good lovers, high maintenance versus low maintenance, married people don't have sex, whether she's attractive or has a good personality, when he's having that talk with Jess before the date. It's one thing after another. And I guess, like, they added the scene, the I'll have what she's having scene, to sort of even the odds. And it became probably the most culturally significant part of this movie and the most identifiable.
Yeah. It's a great scene that goes way over the top in all the right ways. And it really lets the actors do the work, which is something that I will compliment this movie for over and over again, because just letting your actors exist within their talents is a huge, it's like a trust thing that movies have an issue with these days. But when you have star talent like Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal, let them go. Like, just let them have a time together. And it looks like they really did let Billy Crystal do his thing with rewriting parts of his own dialogue and kind of controlling those moments, but also, like, they clearly knew how to reel him back from being a more pompous character than he even is.
I think they get the balance right. Like, again, like, that scene really helps, but I also think Meg Ryan does a lot of good smaller work in this.
I think she's just as good as him, if not sharper, in terms of the nuances of her performance.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's one of the more progressive things about this movie, or one of the things that made it stick out, was that there are some role reversals in it. Harry is largely more romantically impulsive, emotionally uncontrollable, things that I think you would normally ascribe to the woman's character in these conventional hetero rom-coms. So there are interesting things like that, right? Like, he flies off the handle way more, and he has the earlier having his heart broken, takes her longer to reckon with hers. He makes the moves first, right? He's such an interesting romantic comedy lead, because he does just kind of look like a young grandfather. he's got I love Billy Crystal's face, and he's very charming, and he's very funny, but like objectively, it's such an odd choice.
I mean, for us looking back at it, I guess it is, but for some reason I feel like he fit right into that era of, like, That's what a man looks like in 1989.
Yeah. I don't know, I'm wondering, we should do a little bit more research, but I feel like around this time, like, you've got Harrison Ford in romantic movies. You got Tom Hanks even. Like, Tom Hanks has a Tom Hanks face. He doesn't kind of look like anyone else. I would say he's more conventionally handsome than Billy Crystal.
Yeah. But I wouldn't classify either as, like, male studs.
No. Not necessarily. Apologies to Mr. Crystal and Mr. Hanks. We know you're listening out there. You're some of our most committed listeners. And we tell the truth on this podcast, you know?
Sorry, Billy.
So I do want to talk about why this is so popular. I could talk for an hour about sort of the rules aspect of this movie, but I think in general what I wanted to sort of get to was that the movie spends so long saying, here are the rules, and then at the end says there are no rules, right? And the best part of that is that the thing that you've already made a call on in your life, that, oh, it won't work out with that person, or it didn't work out with that person, or they're already my friend, it's already too far gone, it kind of lets the audience walk out being like, I could be standing next to the love of my life right now, and it's just a matter of waiting, just a matter of 12 years, right? I just gotta be patient and it'll happen. And I mean, and that's where I think, like, Hitch is such a bad version of this, because I literally think, isn't the last line in Hitch, he goes, because, like, the Hitch is him talking to the kid. Will Smith is like a dating expert. He talks to the camera and he goes, rule number one about picking up women, yada, yada, yada. And I think the last line is
basic principles. There are none.
Right. Which is just the worst version of what I think When Harry Met Sally so gracefully pulls off. Because again,
Don't you think Will Smith just looked so cool in that movie? Don't you think he's just such a cool actor and guy?
I would say my only connection with that movie is that if I could also charm Eva Mendes, I would like to. So I can aspire to see myself in Hitch's shoes, but that's about it. I would not want to spend that much time with Kevin James, personally.
Well, you know, all you have to do is, you know, kick her in the head off of a Sea-Doo into the Hudson River.
Oh, that's right. And have an allergic reaction to something and get your face all puffy in, like, a charming, vulnerable way.
I will say I can still hear Will Smith being like,
it is not that serious.
Oh! When he sees his reflection.
Yeah, that was, like, in the trailer. I think I saw a lot of that trailer.
Yeah.
I watched that movie.
It's a hit.
I watched a movie on, like, a snowed-in New Year's Eve at a cabin with a group of friends, where we started going through the Airbnb host, like, DVD collection, and we got to Hitch, and that was the one. Like, Hitch did not survive that viewing. We left it dead in a ditch, you know? Like, it was a lot of heckling.
I could imagine.
Because also, I mean, that, like, strategy, dating culture, peacocking, the game thing has aged really poorly culturally.
Oh, yeah.
So that doesn't, none of that helps Hitch. Again, what was I talking about? There are no rules. And yeah. I think that's a nice place to leave people. I think it's a little bit, do I even have to say, like, this movie is manipulative? It's a romantic comedy, and also it's a movie, both of which are inherently manipulative.
Yes. As an audience, you are being manipulated. Get over it.
Yeah. All that said, I enjoyed watching this movie again.
Hell yeah.
It's a great time. Flow is fantastic. We haven't talked at all about its format, where it has interstitial interviews with seemingly real couples.
Yeah.
All of whom, basically from the beginning, are making the argument that there are no rules. You can meet your love of your life in a myriad of ways. So why are you saying it has to happen one way? Look at this couple. They've been together for 55 years and they didn't speak to each other before their wedding. And look at this couple. They hated each other when they met each other. Or this couple, the guy followed her up in the elevator for 5 extra floors. And then all right, Tay.
9 extra floors just to keep talking to her.
9 extra floors.
And then, I mean, the way that they land this plane is then Harry and Sally are interviewed as if they're also a real couple, right?
And that's, like, honestly my least favorite part about this as a structural part of your script. I just, you know, it works, I guess, in the end, but as far as, like, the age range of all the other couples go, they don't really fit in, which I kind of thought was like a bit of an odd decision. Like, if you're going to have Harry and Sally at the end, make them like age them up, make them like 50.
I would have liked
make
some
them
old
like
age 50, makeup.
60 years old. And like,
I mean, just like, make yeah. Billy Crystal look like his character in Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Right. You remember him?
Yeah, I do.
And I mean, it should just like, let's just recognize like this movie makes a lot of comments about all of men and all of women, and it's all straight couples in these interviews and obviously in this thing, right? It was, you know, it's a product of its time, things like that, but it is examining one sliver of the culture at the time, and really only applies to one sliver of the culture.
What I do love about those scenes with featuring the couples as like kind of intermissions almost between or of the plot,
mm-hmm.
I like that they don't implicitly lead you to the next Harry and Sally moment based on the context, but they do offer broader context about relationships. And as they build up, it kind of gets to that point, like what you were saying, where you just recognize there are no strict rules about how this is done. And it's an amalgamation of like, it's the stacking up of all these different stories that eventually allow you to have that revelation. It's not like the first one or the second one or the third one.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's effective that way. And I think it also like the flow works because the first couple interviews come just before like a 5-year jump. So it's not like in between one day to the next day scenes. There is kind of like you get these little chapters and then like it telescopes or I guess microscopes. That was dumb. Where like the later jumps are smaller, right? And I actually think like there's an editing joke or something that I find funny. Maybe it wasn't supposed to be a joke, but there's an interview in between when Jess and Marie meet. And then there's an interview and then it's 4 months later instead of like 5 years later or a year later as it had been before. And they are about to get married. And it's just kind of like this subtle little editing joke that like, yeah, like they met each other and it took almost no time to figure it out. Right.
And then
and
Harry,
and
end,
Sally
Harry and Sally
get engaged in 6 months, right?
Three.
3 months, yeah, 12 years and 3 months, right? Yeah. That's the joke, yeah. So, I mean, I like them, and I think it's, again, it's all sort of around that, as Hitch says.
Basic principles. There are none.
So, speaking of rules, we do have a format here. There is a way that this podcast works, even though there may not be any single one way that a relationship works. We got to get to the scene summary. We talked about the Oscars and also other stuff a lot at the top here.
Yeah, so I guess jumping right into our scene, it's almost as far into the movie as we are into this podcast at 59:55. Yep. The scene goes from 59:55 to 104:06, so it's a four minute 10-second scene. In this scene, after running into his ex-wife Helen, Harry and Sally then visit Mary and Jess, who ask them to settle a domestic debate regarding a living room table. Boiling over, Harry snaps and selfishly chastises them by relating the issue to his past issues with Helen. Cooling down outside, Sally confronts him on his rudeness. And that's kind of like the breakdown of how the scene goes in a broad sense, but it's the nuances and the minutiae that really make the scene really pop for us. Tim, you have some cool points about the cinematography here. As a whole, though, I really like this idea that they're kind of Harry and Sally are almost pigeonholed the same way that they've been pigeonholing all these other people the whole movie here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so like we start the scene off by, again, I like how it establishes it around an item that is sort of at the center of this web of the entire arc of this sequence. And the item is this very sort of ugly wagon wheel coffee table. It's a wagon wheel with like a glass insert on top of it. Jess and Marie are moving in together. They're trying to figure out. So this is Carrie Fisher and Bruno Kirby. I'd say like in the pantheon of like top like romantic comedy buddies, Carrie Fisher just like bats 1,000 in this movie. She's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things where you're like, man, if only she was in a bunch of other movies and not just like Princess Leia a bunch, where
seriously,
you know, doesn't always have a ton to do. She's very funny. I mean, she had a great role on 30 Rock too. We'll do our side podcast on Carrie Fisher another time, though.
But she's really wonderful.
Yeah. they're having an argument about this table and whether or not they're going to keep it in the living room.
It's so awful. There's no way to even begin to explain what's so awful about it.
Honey, I don't object to any of your things.
If we had an extra room, you could put all your things in, including your bar stools. And
well,
I would
honey, wait, honey, wait. You don't like my bar stools?
Jess is in favor of it. It's his. He says it makes it feel like home, or it says home to me. Carrie Fisher, I think very wisely, says it's so bad you can't even start to explain how bad it is. And then like you reverse this dynamic that normally it's Harry and Sally asking these other two people for advice, and they put it to them. And Harry, obviously distracted, still sort of affected by running into his ex-wife in the previous scene and in the sharper image, just sort of blows off judging the table. He says it's nice, and then he moves into the background, and you go from this shot that sort of mirrors them, the two couples, one of which is not a couple yet, across this table, and then you have Harry move out of focus into the background while Sally does some sort of damage control for him, you know?
Yes, I think part of what makes the scene a really important scene is the shifting relationship between Harry and Sally that takes place in front of your eyes here.
Mm-hmm.
We see Sally really take into consideration Harry's personal feelings, and she handles the situation as like a good partner would.
Do we have to talk about this right now?
Yes, I think that right now actually is the perfect time to talk about this, because I want our friends to benefit from the wisdom of my experience.
Or like a really good friend, I guess, in some cases would, where she like takes the brunt of like the heat of the other couple. She kind mm-hmm. of deflects any attention towards him and takes it upon herself. She really like gets in the way of any of him like needing to be part of this action. And then it's only when he yep. chooses to intervene that it becomes a heated scene.
Yeah, and she also like she doesn't let him necessarily get away with it, right? Like there's
exactly.
I think there's there's a very funny edit. It's over the course of two shots where she sort of leans towards him, and then they reestablish the camera angle, and she's sort of leaning from right to left across the frame towards him, and she's like, "Do we really have to do you need to talk about this now?" Right? Like, do we need to talk about your divorce trauma in relation to this wagon wheel table? And there's another like I'm a diehard fan of any time you edit in dialogue without showing the person saying it. And like, there's a part where Billy Crystal's walking around. He's talking about how like the plate that Jess and Marie are unpacking will be the focal point of an argument when they're getting divorced in a couple years, just like it was for him and Helen. And Meg Ryan's voice just sort of like, they're only filming like the back of her head, but she just sort of goes like,
"Harry,
please."
She starts giving him a hard time. I do think, yeah, this scene sort of explores this healthy friendship. And I think that's a part of the conversation of this whole movie, where it's like, well, where's friendship end and begin? What happens when they have sex? Can they be together? What is love in a platonic way? What is love in a romantic way? I think they demonstrate a very strong friendship here. And this is as Harry's going through this valley of emotions and presupposes when Sally will in the next scene or the scene after.
Mm-hmm.
But they address that too in the second half of this sequence. But we can get to that when we leave the apartment.
Yeah. I guess some of the other parts of the scene that I really find important were the shot of Harry as he looks out the window, as he's already been removed from the scene. It's a really good piece of cinematography here as well, because you can still see, I believe, two of the other characters in the background behind him as he kind of mm-hmm. stares out the window, and like almost you can almost like see the steam coming out of his nose as he breathes. Like he's still venting and fuming. And then he eventually, like you see it in the actor's face, him get to a point where he needs to like address what's happening in the room. And that's when he snaps and becomes quite selfishly indulgent in his indictment of yeah. early marital struggles.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking a lot about like anger, snapping, steam, all these sort of more ugly potential emotions. This scene still plays funny.
Yeah.
Because you have Billy Crystal, when he goes big, he's delivering lines like,
"We started out like this, Ellen and I. We had blank walls, we hung things, we picked out tiles together. Then you know what happens? 6 years later, you find yourself singing Surrey with a Fringe on Top in front of Ira!
right? And I was being nice and things like that. And Carrie Fisher and Bruno Kirby both button each aspect of the scene with like a little stinger joke. And they're both so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like how they both handle the scene too, because they could play it like absolutely shattered by what he's saying to them. But they actually like handle it quite optimistically and altruistically, and they both have a funny moment, like you said.
And it's another aspect of like that. It comes up again later, where after Harry and Sally sleep together and they both call Jess and Marie at the same time, that scene ends with Jess being, or Marie saying like, just tell me I'll never have to be out there dating again.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And it's another version of that here, where like very confident and loving and comfortable, where she's like,
I want you to know that I will never want that wagon wheel coffee table.
And they don't. I like that they barely even leave the edit long enough for Jess to react.
They don't.
He's still a little offended. He's still, because like they've established that Jess has specific tastes. He thinks highly of himself and his opinions. Right? He's a writer. All that, you know, New York intellectual stuff. So the idea that someone wouldn't like his Roy Rogers Western, I can't remember all the things that Billy Crystal calls it, table.
This stupid wagon wheel Roy Rogers garage sale coffee table.
I thought you liked it.
I was being nice.
He still doesn't entirely get, and even at the end of this full sequence that we're talking about, he is a little defeated, right? He doesn't feel like he's entirely willingly accepting that he doesn't get to keep this table.
So after Harry kind of blows his fuse inside, they come outside, him and Sally at least.
Well, she tells him to not be emotional, essentially. Again, this reversal in character tropes.
Yeah.
Right? She has to say, like,
Harry, you're going to have to try and find a way of not expressing every feeling that you have every moment that you have them.
Oh, really?
Yes. There are times and places for things.
Well, the next time you're giving a lecture series on social graces, would you let me know? Because I'll sign up.
Every feeling that you have doesn't have to become someone else's problem.
Yeah, and it's something about how he says everything he's feeling in the moment.
Yeah.
And how irrational he can be.
Yeah, and sort of that brings up the topic for Harry to turn it back on her and say, like, well, you never feel anything, right? Like, I know you went through this breakup with this guy, Joe, and you never talk about it. You're not wallowing in it like he is with Helen, right? And so that's when he calls her Miss Little Hospital Corners, which is a term for how the sheets are tucked in on the bed in hospitals. And I think I would associate it more with hotels.
Right.
Right. Like the very specific tuck and fold underneath, and everything is right in its place. That's Harry referring to, like, again, how she orders food and how everything has to be exact and things like that. So that there's the everyone who was sticking around for that answer. You can now stop listening.
Yeah.
You found out what you need to know. But I like
That's
this too, because like, yeah, it does kind of, it gets you set up for, yeah, like, where is, like, is Sally worried about this type of stuff? Where is her despair? Because throughout the course of the movie, you've seen Carrie Fisher playing Marie being in like an unseen cheating relationship, being a mistress of a married man.
In an affair, yeah.
And wishing hopelessly that this guy will leave his wife for her, and everyone just saying, like, as a punchline over and over, like, he's never going to leave his wife, right? And Sally, like, I mean, you know, most of the movie takes place in the 30s. I think they get past some of these earlier, greener relationship touch points. And by the time, you know, you've got that first meeting where it's Marie and Sally and their third friend, whose name I don't know because she's not Carrie Fisher's character, talking about all the people that they've dated and why it didn't work out and things like that. And Marie has a Rolodex of potentially single men, all of which is outdated. Right.
Yeah,
but you don't
she keeps getting all these all this updated information and says, oh, well,
yeah.
And she earmarks one page.
You don't have what I think you see in lots of other rom-coms, where there isn't like, we need to do some work where we have Sally in her apartment alone, crying, getting over some guy, going to the next guy, things like that. She's very level throughout this movie until she sort of hits this same realization that Harry does, which is that I thought the person that loved me actually didn't love me. And her version of that is she thought this guy who broke up with her didn't want to get married at all. And it turns out he didn't want to get married to her. Yeah. Right.
And that's where she ultimately breaks and has to call Harry.
Yeah. And I love that Harry's scene comes first. I do like that they put this on more on the male character. And I think Crystal delivers it all very well. It's very neurotic, but there's a lot of emotion to it that isn't just anger. There is despair and depression.
Yeah.
And even paranoia and things like that, right? And
which keeps this from being a tired scene of him like just being aggressively angry or something like that. There's like humor there's humorous undertones to what he's saying, but there's also genuinely hurt emotions. You can see how affected he is by what just happened in the previous scene. And I like that because his character, yes, has been affected by the divorce, but never so outwardly in the sense that it disrupts his outward character. In like, because he has a very specific way of talking it with speaking with confidence, and that all goes out the door in this scene. He just becomes this brash, irrational man.
Yeah. And that feels very honest. Both of their sort of like despairing scenes. I can definitely say that, like, you know, there are things where you're like, I'm okay with that. I have figured out how to deal with that thing from my past. And then it can appear in front of you, run into a person, something can bring it back up. And you're like, oh, there's tons I actually didn't unpack from that. And they unpack it here. And I like, again, there's a lot of mirroring in this scene between Jess and Marie and Harry and Sally. Harry and Sally's argument resolves with a simple apology and a hug. And it's just after they both communicated. Sally kind of has to unload on him and say, like,
have you slept with one person since you broke up with Joe?
What the hell does that have to do with anything? That will prove I'm over Joe because I fuck somebody? Harry, you're going to have to move back to New Jersey because you've slept with everybody in New York, and I don't see that turning Helen into a faint memory for you. Besides, I will make love to somebody when it is making love, not the way you do it, like you're out for revenge or something.
They also, like, they let her, she gets to use the F word in this, which, again, I can't speak specifically to rom-coms and how often, like, the female characters would speak like that, but it does feel, like, a little bit newer, right? And gives her some aggression and some grit in this scene that I really appreciate. And it's once she's communicated that I think Harry kind of gets it, and he's just like, are you done? And he's like, I'm sorry. And they hug. And you get this sort of resolution, I think, that you can sort of see with Jess and Marie, that the wagon wheel doesn't actually matter. They'll be okay. It's not going to end anything. It's not going to ruin anything. It's an argument they have to get through.
And then, of course, you have the final bookend on the scene as Jess comes out of the house and says,
don't say a word.
Right. And which he's George despondent, Costanza. But like, yeah. Yeah, it's good. But yeah, I mean, that's the scene. I think I covered what I wanted to cover.
Yeah. I mean, we picked this scene because it is reflective of the both relationships, I guess, in one sense or another. But between Harry and Sally, it just really reflects the nuances of what they're doing as friends and then what translates into them becoming a successful couple in the end. Just the ability to communicate and focus each other in the right way. I like the scene for its cinematography, like we talked about. But as a whole, I found like numerous parts of this movie so enjoyable, like numerous scenes exactly like this that were informative, funny, emotional, and well acted. And so it's just a microcosm of this otherwise pretty solid movie.
Yeah, the pacing is solid. Like, it really, no scene overstays its welcome. And they almost all of them, like, and this may be one of the hardest things I assume with like script writing and editing, is like, how do you end a scene? What is the ending point? How do you not just get to a point where you're like, well, we said all the stuff we got to say, and then we're going to move on? And like, it's maybe a little bit more obvious in comedies, but it's like, you got to have that button. You got to have that punctuation, which is a joke, but like, whether the joke works, things like that. And I think this movie, both of the scenes in this sequence and this movie scene by scene, I think they achieve that every time.
Yeah, a really nice balance of emotional content and comedy. Really good stuff on the writing end.
Yeah. Now, Tay, for shout-outs, are you taking us up to Buffalo? I think you are.
yeah. The shout-out. I just love this scene, and I forgot it was happening until, like, midway through the scene, where Harry is telling Jess about his very recent divorce that just happened, and he's telling him about how how Helen gave him this information, and yet in the middle of all this very like difficult conversation for him, they have to keep getting up and standing up to do the wave that's going on in the building in the stadium. And I love how disruptive this is. I love moments like this in movies where a cultural thing is impeding upon like a emotional conversation, and it's just the tension between the two things is in full operation throughout the scene, and I just love that. I think it adds like a it undercuts it, but it doesn't like full it undercuts it in a way that still allows the emotion to play out.
Yeah, so I think it's just a very smart functional choice, because there's so many scenes in this movie where it's just two people talking. Pretty much every scene, right? With the exception of one or two. And they have to find ways in that type of movie to make it interesting, right? And sometimes that's how you shoot it, and sometimes if you give the characters an activity. So, you know, in another one, Harry and Jess are at batting cages, and you've got some action. You've got some dynamism to get on camera. And this one, I love it because, yeah, like, even if you're just locked into what Harry's saying about how much longer his ex-wife knew that she was going to divorce him than he knew, and the movers who show up and all that stuff, subconsciously in the back of your mind, you're like, I know the wave is somewhere in its circuit. When is it coming back? And like, that's an editing challenge too, to make it seem like on a reasonable circuit. Because once you establish one lap, again, I'm not sitting there with a stopwatch, but part of my brain knows roughly how long that lap was. And Crystal and Kirby have to get through their lines, and they have to be edited together in a way that you believe by the time the wave comes back, it didn't like skip half the stadium because they actually cut a line that they didn't really think was necessary.
It's a real cohesion
of script through to editing.
I will say that editing on dialogue throughout the movie is very strong in terms of consistency and continuity. The batting cages is actually the only scene where I noticed a continuity problem. That'll
always be tough.
Always really hard. But
the batting scene opens with like a shot down the barrel, right from behind like the cage, and you see the ball come at Crystal and then go away from Crystal.
Yeah.
And it's such a simple thing, but every time you see something like that, you're like, that was cool.
Yeah.
I'd watch that again.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to talk about something that Tay and I don't get to experience because of the time we live in. And I see in these old movies, I'm like, man, I would love to do that once. And that's talking to someone through their answering machine. It's also a part of Spider-Man 2, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. And we talked about its precursor 2 weeks ago. Harry in this movie, you know, it's the idea that you call somebody, they don't pick up. Their answering machine picks up and starts recording onto a tape. But it also projects the audio into the apartment space through a little PA speaker set. And it's used in sitcoms, it's used in all these things, but it's a real product of like, I don't know, mid 80s to late 90s. And it's not something that we get to do anymore, right? Your smartphone doesn't speak messages at you as they're being recorded. That would be insane.
Yeah, your answering machine is literally like, do not leave me a message.
That's actually mine. Is I can't stand messages because, again, anything you put in a message could probably work better in a text. And my real issue with answering software right now, machine software, is that I have to go through like a touchtone menu to access them, which is ludicrous and insane. And I refuse to be a part of that system.
And that's why I always leave you messages.
Yeah, you do. And I mean, I will say that I recently updated my service plan, and now audio messages just get texted to me. I don't have to go through the menu, but I don't think I've updated my outgoing greeting.
Still the same.
Yeah. My life has been much calmer with having fewer messages and keeping my phone on silent.
Well, people are just scared to do it based on your message.
That's my shout out. It's just sort of like a facet of the times, and I find it a very charming thing in retrospect. I guess for recommendations, I'm going with The Other Side of the Meg Ryan Spectrum, a movie that was not well received. I think it's got around a 35% on Rotten Tomatoes at the moment. Did not make a ton of money, and I find it to be super interesting. It's called In the Cut. It's a Jane Campion movie from 2003. It's like a psychological thriller in which Meg Ryan plays a New York inner city school teacher who becomes involved with a detective, Mark Ruffalo, who is investigating a serial killer in New York. It's sweaty and grimy and handheld camera, and it's uncomfortable. I mean, people did not like it when it came out, and it's had a bit of a reestablished legacy because it's largely from Meg Ryan's perspective in it. And there's a lot being done by Campion and Meg Ryan in developing female agency, in displaying female pleasure, things that were not really being done in film at the time. And people didn't like it. I think like the consensus was that Meg Ryan was the wholesome rom-com star, and how dare she be in an explicit thriller like this? How dare she betray the movie audiences of the day? It's a real shame because I think, you know, actors should be allowed to try other things. They fail sometimes, but I think she gives a good performance. I think there's a lot of cool stuff that happens in this movie. It's a bit of a bummer. It won't make you feel the same way you feel walking out of When Harry Met Sally. But it's interesting to see the range that Meg Ryan had and that the public largely did not allow her to exercise.
I'm very interested in checking out more of Jane Campion's film, so I will make sure that stays on the list. It is on my list right now because I think you've told me about it before or somewhat recently.
Yeah, in the past year I went through all of Campion's stuff around Power of the Dog. All her films are interesting, if not fascinating. Not all of them work. But again, that's sometimes a better thing than a worse thing when you look at filmmakers who make multiple versions of the same thing over and over.
Right.
But yeah, definitely check it out if you like how any of that sounded. If you didn't, I don't blame you. I wasn't trying to hide any of the smuttiness or the griminess that's in the cut. Tay, what do you bring to the table? Something equally despondent and nihilistic?
No. Actually, I'm not the nihilistic, despondent one this week, Tim. I am.
No, not this time.
I'm the proclaimer of love and rom-coms because this, from the very same year as Hitch, from the very same year as Hitch, I think, the movie A Lot Probably. Like Love, which is a Nigel Cole film from 2005. It stars Amanda Peet and Ashton Kutcher. Not anything particular about this movie that I would say, like, this is why I went into like this movie. It's actually just a movie I stumbled upon around that time in the early 2000s, and I just liked it. It's just a solid movie. It's a good burst of nostalgia. If you go back to watch it now, it's got like a, you know, some what's that song, like, is it not Matchbox 20, not Blink-182, what's the
Oh yeah, I know. I know what you're talking about.
It's a very like dated early 2000s pop score. You'll recognize all the music.
It's a nice
from
document
it.
Of the time.
Yeah, and
I watched this one on your recommendation because I think it was back when we were doing the poll for Valentine's Day.
Yeah,
and you said like, oh, do My Bloody Valentine because it'll be nice to get a different genre in there. And then I think you were like, you all said like, if like a rom com, then A Lot Like Love, and I had never heard of it. So I checked it out, and yeah, it's a fun time, and it is nice to just sort of revel in the early aughts of it all. I think Amanda Peet is great.
She's so good in it.
Again, I think with our generation, we didn't get to see as much of her. She wasn't really a movie star by the time I started going to see more movies.
Exactly.
She was just a little bit like probably like, you know, an older siblings generation of that with like the whole Nine Yards, stuff like that was probably peak fame for her. But
that's right.
She's great. Kutcher, I think, does the job. I struggle to see his appeal. I don't dislike him, but I never got how big he was.
I think if you were to see him in this movie and never see him again in the movie, you'd be like, yeah, he's good.
He
plays the guy from that time.
Yeah, that 70s show makes more sense because I think he got that sort of like incredibly stupid thing down.
he does.
Yeah. And I mean, now he's like a venture capitalist or something. I don't know.
Well, what would you do with all that 70s show money?
I don't know. Invest in apps, I guess. Bitcoin, whatever he's doing.
So no better.
Maybe
than
that's
what
how
he's
it
doing.
Works. Don't worry about Ashton Kutcher right now, even though he was in a rom-com this year, wasn't he, with Reese Witherspoon. We just talked for an hour and a half about how there are no rom-coms. I'm pretty sure, like, 3 weeks ago, he put out a rom-com.
Oh, wow. I don't know. I saw him in a movie called Vengeance this year.
Oh, yeah, you dug that one. I heard mixed things about it.
I thought it was a good movie overall, and I thought he was particularly a good performer in it. Intentionally over the top.
He put out a movie with Reese Witherspoon in 2023 called Your Place or Mine. Came out February 10th. We just completely missed it and glossed over it. It has roughly the same Rotten Tomatoes score as In the Cut, so do with that as you will.
I'm really ashamed that we didn't base our podcast around that movie instead in February, but you know what? I'm not going to regret it.
It is what it is, you know? But with that, I mean, we're wrapping up March. We're heading out of New York and headed into, well, not the Mushroom Kingdom, because to be clear, we're not going to talk about Mario. I don't plan on seeing it.
Yeah, maybe ever.
I'm not even sure if that's like a Sunday afternoon streaming checkout for me, unless it's like this sleeper hit, you know, where they're like, oh, it actually is interesting and has commentary and is well, it looks like it may actually be very well animated. I gotta tell you something about Chris Pratt playing Mario that makes me immediately just hang up the phone.
You asked for it. This is fun.
Yeah, I'm a little nauseous at the thought.
With apologies to our Italian listeners out there. We know you're not properly represented when it comes to Mario.
Yeah, we feel your pain.
But we are going to talk other animated movies. I think we're going to get some In the Vote. We're going to get some Miyazaki back in there. It's been a long time since we got to talk Miyazaki. We're going to get... I'm not actually sure who produced that one, and I don't want to give it away.
Yeah, let's just...
What else do we have on that list?
Let's keep it secret.
You'll find out. You'll find out what's on the vote when you find out. And you'll find out what we're going to talk about when you find out, too. Calm down, everybody.
Stop hassling us. You'll get it eventually.
All right, the episode's done, and you'll know it's done when you hear Will Smith yell at his allergy-afflicted reflection. Take it away, Will.
Oh, and if you do want to leave Tim a message, we'll leave his number in the show notes.